Call Senate Resources Committee to order. Today is Friday, March 20th, 2015. The time is 3:31 p.m. Let the record reflect that committee members present today, Vice Chair Costello, Senator Stoltz, Senator Stedman, Senator Machicki, Senator Coghill, Senator Wadakowski, and myself, Senator Giesel. Our recording secretary, Anne, our audio person, Thatcher, thank you so much for your help. Committee aide, Ike Gilopsis, is helping us out here with all the abundant pieces of paper we have for this committee. So today, we are going to take up three items. First, we're going to take up Senate Bill 8. Right after that, we will revisit House Joint Resolution Number 4, which was heard on Monday. And lastly, we'll take up Senate Bill 57, which was heard on Wednesday. So we'll start out with Senate Bill 8. We invite the sponsor staff to come up and explain the bill and answer questions for us. So welcome.
Thanks. Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Matt Moser, staff to Senator Johnny Ellis, representing downtown Anchorage. On behalf of Senator Ellis, I'd like to first start by thanking the committee for your time and consideration today, and to pass along Senator Ellis's regrets. He's sorry that he can't be here. He had a previous commitment. It pleases the committee, I'd like to just start briefly with a few remarks regarding industrial hemp and then move into a sectional analysis.
That'd be wonderful. Thank you.
First, as some of you know, industrial hemp is an ancient crop that's been cultivated by humans for thousands of years. Many of you may also know that some of our founding fathers, Presidents George Washington, John Adams, and Thomas Jefferson, all grew hemp on their farms. Additionally, the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution were both written on hemp papers. It's ironic that a crop so important to American history is still illegal today. And it's an issue that's been gaining traction around the country. There's about 19 states that have embraced pilot studies or hemp production across the country. And Madam Chair, believe it or not, industrial hemp is an issue that we can come together on to fight federal overreach with. As Mike Meharry of the 10th Amendment Center said regarding the Maryland legislature's recent action on industrial hemp, and I quote, he said, "When enough people tell the feds to pound sand, there's not much D.C. can do to continue their unconstitutional prohibition of this productive plant." And Madam Chair, this is also an issue that brings Republicans and Democrats together, and it's part of what drew Senator Ellis to the issue originally. On the federal level, Kentucky Senators Mitch McConnell and Rand Paul have introduced the Industrial Hemp Farming Act, co-sponsored by Oregon Senators Ron Wyden and Jeff Merkley. Newly elected Senator from Colorado, Cory Gardner, has recently signed on. Colorado is another state where industrial hemp production is moving forward. And Madam Chair, if pleases the committee, I'd just like to briefly run through a sectional analysis or talk about the details of the bill.
That'd be great,
before
Matt.
We get to some invited testimony. So the bill before you today is currently drafted. Section 1 adds a new section to Title 3, titled Industrial Hemp, defining industrial hemp as an agricultural crop here in Alaska, and establishes a license procedure in the Department of Natural Resources. That allows a licensed hemp producer to plant, grow, harvest, process, possess, sell, or buy industrial hemp. It also requires the Department of Natural Resources to adopt regulations. If members want to follow along, on page 2, line 6, this legislation requires a licensed industrial hemp grower to document and file verification that the industrial hemp seeds that they have used are certified and documented to not or to have less than 0.3% tetrahydrocannabinol, which is the THC, the psychoactive ingredient in recreational marijuana. Moving along on page 2, line 19 sets in statute this definition of industrial hemp, that it has less than 0.3% tetrahydrocannabinol, and that's other states have set 1% and 0.3% are the two numbers that states have used across the country. Section 2 on page 2, line 21, creates an affirmative defense to prosecution for a properly licensed hemp grower. Moving along to Section 3, this is page 3, line 4, allows the Department of Public Safety to conduct a national criminal history record check for licensure as an industrial hemp producer. This is something other states have included in their statutes, a background check for growers. Finally, Section 4 on page 3, line 6, states that a properly licensed producer of industrial hemp is not required to be licensed as a marijuana establishment under the other statutes related to recreational marijuana. And that concludes my run-through of the sectional, Madam Chair. Happy to take any questions. I did want to mention we have some folks online from the National Conference of State Legislatures and the Hemp Industries Association that are on East Coast time, a couple hours ahead of us on a Friday evening. And before I conclude my remarks, I did want to mention Frank Turney in Fairbanks asked me to mention that he's listening in today. He's been a longtime industrial hemp advocate in the Fairbanks area and was the I think the driving force behind the resolutions of support from the Fairbanks North Star Borough and the Fairbanks City Council a few years back.
Great. Well, thank you, Matt. I do see some folks. In fact, Scott Hendrick just signed on from NCSL, but I think senators have some questions. I saw Senator Stoltz first.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. Just a quick question on everything I've heard. This is a benign, non-drug substance. Why would there have to be a criminal registry for it? Just because other states do it, if it isn't, there's no inherent danger, and it is just another agricultural product. And that's the only question I have to start.
Sure. Senator Stoltz, through the chair, that's an excellent question. And something, or that component of the bill was something that we used from model legislation in other states. And when I was speaking to the governor's folks, they said the exact same thing, that is this really necessary to have a criminal background check for an agricultural process. And I think the sponsor of the bill absolutely agrees that it's probably not necessary, but just a piece of the model legislation from other states that ended up in this draft.
Thank you.
Possibly a best practices type of approach. Was that all, Senator Stoltz? All right, Senator Walikowski.
Yeah, I think it's actually still considered a controlled substance by the federal government. That's probably why you need to take some actions, which leads me to ask the question of, is the a federal SWAT team going to break down my door and arrest me if I eat this hemp granola bar?
You can have mine, too.
Senator Walikowski, through the chair, very good question. In fact, there's the hemp products across the United States are growing by double digits every year. It's hundreds of millions of dollars worth of hemp products that are manufactured here, but right now the U.S. is an importer of industrial hemp. The raw materials from China and Canada is another major producer of hemp. So no, the feds won't interfere with your snack there, sir.
Any other questions for, yes, Senator Michicki?
Sort of unrelated to the bill, Madam Chair, if you don't mind, but do we have growing conditions and soils in Alaska that would facilitate hemp production?
Senator Michicki, through the chair, that's a great question, and there's been lots of discussion in the agricultural community since we proposed this legislation and some debate. There's a number of different opinions. I've found some information about hemp growing in northern Russia, and the government of British Columbia has a white paper about hemp production in Canada that I've looked to for some guidance about the possibility. So there is some debate about whether or not how well the industrial hemp would do here. I think folks agree that it would grow here, but whether or not how well it would grow here, I think, is the subject of the debate.
Thank you.
Good. Well, if it's all right with you, we will go now to Scott Hendrick, NCSL. Scott, can you hear us?
I can. Thank you very much.
Welcome. If you would identify yourself for the record and your affiliation and give us your testimony.
Thank you very much. For the record, my name is Scott Hendrick, and I am a program director at the National Conference of State Legislatures. Good afternoon, Madam Chair and members of the committee. I appreciate the opportunity to speak with you today about state actions on industrial hemp. I will keep my comments brief, but will be happy to answer any questions you may have either during or after my remarks. As a preface to my presentation, I would like to note that NCSL is a bipartisan organization that presents research and analysis to state legislatures. We do not take positions on issues debated in the states, so my purpose here today is to provide information on how other states have considered this issue and not to suggest that Senate Bill 8 or any other related piece of legislation should or should not be adopted by you all today. As you know, there's been a lot of action in state houses around the country recently on industrial hemp. This is primarily driven by the inclusion of a provision in the 2014 Federal Farm Bill that authorized states to pursue industrial hemp pilot projects through their universities or departments of agriculture, although I should note that a number of states had considered and in some cases passed legislation to promote the industrial hemp industry prior to the federal law change last year. To date, there are 22 states that have passed laws on industrial hemp. Seven states have laws establishing hemp research programs, usually administered by a state agency or a university. And these states are Delaware, Hawaii, Illinois, Michigan, Nebraska, New York, and Utah. And then Connecticut and New Hampshire have passed laws to study industrial hemp. And then there are 13 other states that have passed laws to establish a commercial industrial hemp program similar to what is being considered with Senate Bill 8. These states are California, Colorado, Indiana, Kentucky, Maine, Montana, North Dakota, Oregon, South Carolina, Tennessee, Vermont, Virginia, and West Virginia. I should note, however, that some of these states will not start issuing licenses until they are either granted waivers from the DEA or until changes are made to federal law. So in some cases, we have state laws on the books, but those aren't being acted upon right now. But there are several states, such as Washington and Colorado, that are moving forward with their commercial hemp programs. I believe this committee will most be interested in these types of laws, so I'll focus my remarks on their elements and how they compare to the language of Senate Bill 8. I'll also mention that there are several other policy options adopted by other states that I didn't see included in the proposed legislation, but that I'll mention today just for your consideration. So to start out by looking at Senate Bill 8, I do want to note that it is very representative of industrial hemp program laws that we've seen considered and enacted in other states. As you've heard, it defines industrial hemp, it establishes a licensing scheme, sets regulatory requirements for growers, provides for inspection and oversight, and grants an affirmative defense for prosecution under state substance control laws. These are also areas that other states have generally addressed with their laws. So now taking a look at these specific provisions and comparing them to other states, Senate Bill 8's definition of industrial hemp in Section 1E is pretty much in line with other state definitions. Some states have also chosen to include in their definition that the plant must have a, quote, delta-9, end quote, THC concentration of not more than 0.3%. And many other states' laws also specify that the THC limits are, quote, on a dry weight basis, or something along those lines. In terms of the licensing scheme, requirements are also... I'm sorry?
Nothing. Keep going. Thank you.
I'll continue. In terms of the licensing scheme, Senate Bill 8's requirements are also very similar to other state laws. There are a few items in this area that some states have chosen to adopt that I wanted to highlight because, I didn't see them in the bill. For instance, in Section 1C of the bill, there is not a requirement that the license seekers submit GPS coordinates or a map of the growing area, and this is something that we've seen other states require of their licensees. States such as Indiana and Kentucky prohibit anyone who has been convicted of a drug-related offense in the last 10 years from obtaining a grower's license. Some states require written consent with a license application that explicitly allows access to the growing property for testing and inspections. Some states set terms for licenses stating that they are only valid for a certain time period, and usually this time period is between 1 to 3 years for those states that have chosen to put a time limit on the license. And then in Oregon's law, it explicitly states that a license is a personal privilege and not transferable. So moving on to the regulatory requirements in Section 1D of the bill, there is a provision that the licensee has to provide documentation that seeds planted are of a type and variety certified to grow industrial hemp having no more than 0.3% THC. Some other states have more detailed seed certification requirements in statute. For example, California's law establishes an approved list of seed types, and Colorado's law formally establishes a seed certification program. I should note as well that some states have slightly different regulatory requirements for seed growers as opposed to those growing the crop itself. These requirements for the seed growers can relate to inspection and record keeping in terms of who keeping records of who they sell to and preserving those records for a certain time period. And then also in terms of the amount, requirements as to the amount and type of inventory that they can hold at any one time. The Senate Bill 8 would also require the licensee to share with the state any contract to grow industrial hemp. This is a small difference we've seen elsewhere, but in states like Colorado, they actually require proof of a contract before a license can even be issued. And then most of the other regulatory requirements in the proposed bill closely align with language in other states. I also want to note that some state laws are more detailed in terms of their oversight and inspection systems, providing a little bit more detail about how inspections and testing can take place and what to do if test samples come back with THC amounts higher than what's acceptable under the law. Section 2 of Senate Bill 8 provides an affirmative defense for prosecution under the controlled substances laws. Some states, such as Colorado, extend this protection to include people who are processing, selling, or otherwise distributing industrial hemp grown by a person who's registered under their law. So it's a bit of an extension of that immunity or defense anyway. And in Montana, in order to for the defense to apply, the licensee must also, quote, have valid applicable controlled substances registrations with the USDEA, end quote. And before I finish, I want to briefly describe some additional policy options that states have adopted. And again, these are just for your consideration. Some states have created boards or committees to advise the state regulatory agency on laws and regulations, enforcement, and budgetary matters. Some states have also adopted rather detailed seed registration and certification programs. Again, for instance, California's law establishes an approved list of seed cultivars or types, and Colorado has a rather detailed seed certification program set out in statute. Some state laws specifically set up an industrial hemp fund to support the program. Money into the fund into these funds usually includes registration or licensing fees, but in some states they specifically authorized grants from foundations or private individuals to help support the fund. I'll note too that Colorado uses a portion of its revenues from marijuana sales taxes to support the industrial hemp fund as well. In terms of penalties, some states authorize civil penalties of up to $2,500 per violation, and that's the amount that we've seen in a few other states. We've also seen minimum acreage requirements. Usually these are about 5 acres or greater for growers of the crop and 2.5 acres or greater for seed cultivators. Some states have considered the transportation of hemp away from the grow site and require agents transporting the harvest to carry with them the licensing documentation. And then finally, in California, that law requires sample testing of industrial hemp crops immediately before the harvest. So they'll check right before harvest whether the plant's THC levels are exceeding the acceptable limits. As I wrap up, I'd like to note that NCSL has a website which provides a summary and citations to all these industrial hemp statutes. And I'll also note that I am in the process of doing an update to that website. So if you check back early next week, that will have all the current that will reflect the information that I've presented to you today. And then we also track industrial hemp legislation on our agriculture and rural development legislation database. And both the website and the legislation database are not only available to you all as state legislators and to your staffs, but also to the public. Again, thank you for the opportunity to speak with you today. I'm happy to take any questions now, and I will stay on the line for the rest of the hearing should you have any questions for me after the other presentation. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Hendrick. I believe Senator Stoltz had a question for you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a quick question. Does each individual state do their own seed certification, soil certification, and product certification?
Senator Stoltz, through the chair, that's a great question. There are some states that have set up the seed certification program. There are, frankly, a number of states who have passed laws that don't establish a seed certification program, and so to my knowledge, they're not doing anything.
And Madam Chair, the other part of the question, the levels of drug content in the product, I think that was actually the more relevant question.
Thank you. Senator Stoltz, through the chair. Yes, the level of drug content is, I believe, set at the same amount as for the crop itself, from what I've seen from memory.
Very good. Another follow-up?
Oh,
yes.
The same question, Madam Chair. Does each state then responsible for conducting those tests?
Yes, Senator, through the chair. Yes, each state would be responsible for doing those tests.
And just to follow up, just helping us determine fiscal impact and the correctness of statement, is the federal government able to render any assistance through the Department of Agriculture through providing these types of certifications and tests as they do on other agricultural products?
Senator, through the chair, I am not aware of any federal assistance. That's not to say there isn't any, but I'm just not aware of any of that. Perhaps the next presenter might have some more detailed information about that.
Thank you.
Great. Any other questions? Yes. Senator Machiki has a question for you, Mr. Hendrick.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Hendrick, just to, remember the stories about our founding fathers, some of them being industrial hemp growers and things like that. But the question I have has a little to do with Senator Stoltz's question earlier. Seems like the controls, background checks, and the fact that a convicted felon could not work in the industry seem a little extreme if we're looking at industrial hemp as not being a substance that has any potential for abuse. Why would we go to that level? Is that just to sort of sell the bill, or it seems excessive?
Senator Machiki, through the chair, thanks for your question. I can't really speak to why certain provisions are or are not included in the bill. I will say, I think there has been some concern that I've heard expressed by others that that if you allow industrial hemp, that in some way it might ease, there might be a way for people to grow marijuana in those plots, and so perhaps it's a way of trying to protect against that. But I'm only relaying comments that I've heard, and I don't know, the validity of those comments or if that is leading to these specific provisions being included in some of these laws. But it might also have to do, as one of the members of the committee mentioned, the fact that that industrial hemp is still considered on a federal level to be a controlled substance. So that might have something to do with the inclusion of these provisions.
Any other questions? Follow-up, Senator Machiki?
At what point does the controlled substance become a product that doesn't require where it's no longer controlled? At what point of processing, typically?
Senator Machiki, through the chair, I'm not sure, actually. I know, the state definitions of industrial hemp have definitions for the plant, and then there are a number of state statutes that define the industrial hemp product separately, obviously, from the plant itself. In terms of under federal law, I'm not an expert, and I wouldn't be able to know exactly when the switch is, but if the product has zero levels of THC in it, then that would be fine, and it wouldn't be an issue.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Hepp. Mr. Hendrick, another question, Senator Stoltz?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess on the founding fathers, I wonder who the founding fathers had helping them on this cultivation project, too. But I'm not sure. The question on the, I asked about any federal assistance. Alaska gets about $3.5 billion at USDA, and there have been just light touches on the issue of the federal control of this, and I would not want to have expectations that of what the federal government will be involved with. I know there's a lot of the farm bureaus and the there's a lot of marketing and other assistance on this up front. I'd sure like to know, is there eligibility for this? Is the federal government going to be involved? And because that's a large part of some aspects. Some of my best supporters of the farm community don't take anything, and they're there despite government, not because of it.
All right.
Senator Stoll, through the chair, I was just going to mention that I'd be happy to look into what federal assistance might be available, or at least to put members of the committee in touch.
Or prohibited.
In the federal government who might be able to provide some more information on that. Thank you.
Any other questions for Mr. Hendrick? So, Matt, I have three people online who wish to give public testimony. Did you have any other invited testimony, folks? This was the only person calling in from NCSL.
Madam Chair, yeah, that sounds right. If
okay.
Whoever's online, that would be perfect.
Okay. Oh, Mayor DeVille is also. Okay, thank you. I want to mention that Francie Hebenmeister is online also. She's the director of the Division of Agriculture, so she's available for questions. But I'm also advised that Mayor Larry DeVille was also invited testimony. So he's online. Mayor DeVille, can you hear us?
I can.
Welcome. If you would identify yourself for the record and give us your testimony.
Yes, thank you. This is Mayor Larry DeGilbus. I'm the mayor of the Mat-Su Borough. And I thank you for taking up this issue. It's one among many that our assembly requested to draw a line and define separately the hemp issue. As you may or may not know, I'm also a farmer, and in my travels I've seen hemp, industrial hemp growing down in South America. I've researched the product for its potential up here, and I think there is potential. My personal opinion is that probably not a massive commercial potential there, but like many things in Alaska, there's a niche value. The seed is available at places like Costco, and I have constituents that swear by that seed. One gentleman that's 92 years old, and he credits it all to that hemp seed, and even has a Bible verse to support it. So I appreciate that you're offering to treat hemp differently. I can testify that it's not a plant that's going to be confused visually or any other way with marijuana plants. They're not even remotely alike. And there is some value to that that plant for breaking up compacted ground, and it could be that it will have some value there as a manure crop or something like that, if there's not a commercial value for the fiber. So that's about it. I don't have a lot to say, but I want to thank you for your services, and glad to hear my Mr. Stoltz, first time officially connected with the word senator on a committee.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor DeVilbiss. Any questions for Mayor DeVilbiss? Anyone? All right. We'll go to our next person that's online, and that's Bryce Wrigley. He's with the Alaska Farm Bureau. Mr. Wrigley, can you hear us?
Yes, I can. Thank you.
Welcome. Identify yourself and your affiliation, and we'd love to hear your testimony.
For the record, my name is Bryce Wrigley. I'm president of the Alaska Farm Bureau. Thanks for the opportunity to testify in favor of SB8. It's kind of an unfortunate thing that industrial hemp carries such a stigma as it does being associated with marijuana, because the two crops, I guess, are significantly different in their threat. As the sponsor indicated in his opening statement, hemp is a very versatile crop, provides provides fiber and oil that can be used in a wide range of products. In the health food world, in fact, hemp seeds are considered a superfood with up to 20% protein. In fact, that the United States imports hemp products to the tune of about $2 billion a year underscores the marketability of those products in America, and it seems that if the products are safe to import, the products could also be safely grown here. I believe that the low level of THC contained in industrial hemp provides the necessary safeguards to the public health for industrial hemp to be researched in Alaska. What's unclear at this time is whether this crop can be grown to maturity here so that the desired products can then be processed into suitable items. The development of hemp varieties with the required low THC concentration, the short season, and other desirable traits is the proper purview of the University of Alaska Fairbanks. This is our land-grant university for the state, with land and facilities in different areas of the state to provide a wide range of trial locations. And I want to stress how important it is that this research be conducted in a controlled manner by legitimate researchers who can evaluate the traits, measure the THC levels, and screen for unintended risks. Even if no varieties are found that can mature at our latitude, there is promise for industrial hemp as a cover crop for green manure or to suppress weeds. A proper method for determining whether this is a good opportunity for Alaskan farmers is for UAF to do the research and pass the breeder seed to the Plant Material Center for grow out and sale to the individual farmers. Thank you for this opportunity.
Thank you very much, Mr. Wrigley. Senator Stoltz has a question for you.
Thank you, Mr. Wrigley. Good to hear from you. Has the Farm Bureau officially endorsed the hemp growing in past or current meetings?
Senator Stoltz, through the chair, this is the first time it's really officially come before the Farm Bureau, and we did have a meeting at the beginning of this week, and this bill was officially endorsed, yes.
Thank you.
Thank you. Just a 10-second indulgence?
Sure.
Just pass along my greetings to Stephen, and I want to make sure he's keeping you straight in the flower business there.
Through the chair, thank you, Senator Stoltz. I will sure do that, and he'll be happy to hear from you.
Thank you.
Great, thank you. Senator Costello also has a question for you, Mr. Wrigley.
Thank you, Mr. Wrigley. I was just curious, in your discussions, as the head of the Farm Bureau, can you anticipate, if this legislation were to pass, how large of an industry are we talking about, and have there been any farmers that have expressed interest to you, for growing hemp?
Through the chair, Senator Costello, I am not aware of anyone who has officially or individually asked me or mentioned to me that they are willing to grow, interested in growing it. And I think the future of the hemp industry is probably largely dependent on whether we find out that it can be grown to maturity or not. It's my understanding that in order to be effectively used, for example, the seeds and the oil and things like that, that the plant does need to mature. However, we do struggle in Alaska with alternative crops, rotational crops. We're limited, particularly in the north, as to what crops can be rotated with barley and grains and things like that. And so there's certainly possibilities that hemp could provide a green manure crop or a method of suppressing weeds. It does grow very densely, and that has become an issue in some locations as far as being able to control those weeds.
No, a follow-up, thank you. So that research then, would that be done by the University of Alaska Fairbanks or individual farmers?
Through the chair, Senator Costello, might. Strong recommendation is that it be done through the University of Alaska Fairbanks. They have a capability not only of evaluating the various aspects of this as a crop and determining, what varieties would be the best, THC levels, things like that, but in this process of evaluation, I think that it would be, especially this early in the game, I think that it would be helpful to, rather than passing seeds out to whoever was interested in growing it and then having kind of a slipshod approach to research, that it would be much better to have that research done by an accredited university. Again, the land-grant universities were established to provide that, and that information was to be disseminated, was meant to be disseminated through cooperative extension, and the Plant Material Center here in Alaska was tasked with growing those crops out as they were determined to be viable. And I think that it's important that we reestablish that, the importance of that university in that process.
Thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions? Senator Stoltz, you had another question from Mr. Wrigley?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Wrigley, you talk about the density of which this plant or weed grows. Is there any danger of becoming an invasive with the density of which it grows? Or I guess that's just the question.
Senator Stoltz, through the chair, that's a really good question, the one we discussed for some time on Monday in our meeting. My understanding is that there are places in the United States where this can become an invasive weed. It is spread by seed, and so one would hope that if it can mature up here, that it would be managed properly, and that the seed would be harvested, or if the plant was harvested prior to mature seed setting. But that is something, and I think that that's another reason, a compelling reason to involve the university. Those folks understand the importance of invasive issues that we face, and they would, I think, ensure the ability to determine if it had potential for becoming an invasive plant.
Thank you. Thank you.
All right, seeing no more questions for Mr. Wrigley, thank you very much for speaking to us. So I'm going to open public testimony now. I see I've got two people for sure, and we'll start with the off-net. Jim Sykes is there. For this segment, I'm going to limit public testimony to 2 minutes, so try to be concise and let us know your feelings about the bill, up or down. So Mr. Sykes, can you hear us?
Yes, I can hear you. Can you hear me?
Yes, very clearly. Welcome. So if you'd introduce yourself and your affiliation and give us your testimony.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. My name is Jim Sykes. I am speaking for myself. I am an elected member of the Matsur Borough Assembly, but I am speaking for myself as the Assembly has not actually considered the details of the bill, but we were okay with the mayor testifying in favor of it here. I also would like to personally speak in favor of it. I thought the ideas of putting a THC dry weight and allowing for inspection at any time of a crop. The previous speaker talked about testing, and I think that that's very important. I hope that we do have a good testing program that will also help out perhaps with the medical marijuana and the recreational marijuana, that testing becomes a very important thing. And I personally don't know if it's got potential to be a good crop or not, but as long as it's illegal, we'll probably never find out. And there doesn't seem to be a lot of downsides to it. So as you consider the upsides and downsides, if you're aware of some real downsides, I haven't really come across them. And barring that, I think we ought to let the university and farmers have an opportunity to see what they can do with it. And that's all I've got to say, and thank you for your work on the bill.
Thank you very much, Mr. Sykes, for your testimony. Any questions for Mr. Sykes? All right, seeing none. Let's see, I have now at the Fairbanks LIO, Frank Turney is online. Mr. Turney, can you hear us?
Yes, I can. Can you hear me?
Yes, very clearly. Thank you. So introduce yourself and your affiliation and give us your testimony.
Frank Turney. I'm just a community activist. I've been involved with this industrial hemp for probably a good 20 years now, and I want to thank Senator John Ellis and the Senate Resource Committee for taking this up. First of all, the scientific origins of the word is not marijuana. That's a mongrel. And in fact, there's 3 decades of using that as a racist tool against blacks and minorities throughout this country for 30 years. The real terminology is cannabis. It's been around for 10,000 years for industrial uses and medicinal uses. Cannabis sativa L is grown for industrial production like fiber oils. Now the cannabis sativa C is grown for medicinal and recreational uses. And I would like to say one thing about cannabis hemp. Most biomass need a lot of water. That's one thing about hemp. It's so unique that it just needs a little bit of water and a little bit of sunshine. We're talking about 3 to 4 months. We're talking about 10 tons per acre, 6 to 8 tons per acre of biomass. And not only that, 50,000 products can be made from hemp fiber and oils. And I know I buy my hemp products at Fred Meyer's. They're all imported, hemp bread, hemp chocolate milk, hemp granola bars, hemp bread. Just like somebody shared a hemp granola bar here earlier, and hemp oatmeal. All these oils have been either come from Canada or have been made down in Oregon. Even I have hemp soap, organic hemp soap, and hemp shampoo. So, but we should be able to grow our own hemp right here in Alaska and have only hemp products. And also, people worry about the sterilizing of the seed. I'll wrap it up. Right now, hemp vodka. And it's called Purgatory, and it's been authorized by the DEA. It's got certified by the state of Alaska, and they get their seeds sterilized from Canada. That's where they get their seeds to make hemp vodka right here in Wasilla. So there's no reason why we can't be able to go industrial hemp. I just had a lot of, but my time is very valuable here, and I appreciate having this committee, and hopefully we can have hearings on it and get bipartisan support, not just from Democrats, but from Republicans as well. And I hope that Senator Cargill, you can join in. Thank you. I've given you a lot of information over the years, Senator. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony, Mr. Turney. Any questions for Mr. Turney? All right, seeing none. Is there anyone else online who wishes to testify? Answer is no. Is there anyone else in the room that would wish to testify on this bill? Seeing none, I'm going to keep public testimony open. Committee members, any questions? Yes, Senator Stoltz.
Madam Chair, I see Division of Agriculture Director is online, and we've got DNR in the room. I have a couple of questions regarding for the department from their perspective.
Thank you, Senator Stoltz. How about we speak to Director Heavenmeister? Is that all right, or?
Okay. Or, and if she needs any help, I think there's a DNR person.
Oh, she's right. Waving us off.
All right. Francie Heavenmeister, can you hear us?
Yes, Madam Chair, I can.
Welcome to the committee. If you would identify yourself and your affiliation, Senator Stoltz has some questions.
Thank you.
Hold one steady. Let her identify herself.
Thank you.
Go ahead, Francie.
For the record, my name is Francie Heavenmeister. I'm the Director for the Division of Agriculture.
Thank you. Senator Stoltz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Director Heavenmeister, I'd like you just to go over what you see the role of your department. There's a fiscal note with some commentary with a numerical request. Can you describe the activities you think your department would perform in this and why you need that amount of money?
Yes, through the Chair, Senator Stoltz. And the fiscal note attached would be the funds strictly to write the regulations for this crop. We did not go into the production. We felt that the regulations needed to be addressed first and foremost. And once the regulations were in place, it would allow industry to move forward and possibly start production of the crop.
Thank you.
Senator Stoltz?
Yeah, Madam Chair, they're all zero out-year costs. If this were to become an industry, which I guess somebody will try to grow it if it's legalized, and what's the department's role in what do you see future, what are potential costs down the road as we have to be very cautious about what we get into and know the department costs and division costs. What are some anticipated costs and roles you'd see of your department?
Through the Chair, Senator Stoltz, our additional costs, as are outlined in the bill, would be the regulatory aspect of that, and we would look at ourselves if the bill passes as written as being the licensing agency as well as the regulator, the one who has oversight, the one who is involved when hemp contracts are made. I believe part of the bill here requires industry to provide that information to the commissioner and any other sort of technical assistance.
Follow-up?
Thank you, Madam Chair. When we had in State Affairs, we had the commercialization of marijuana bill. I and other members of the committee asked some very specific questions and elicited and received answers from the division about their role, which included making agricultural revolving loan funds, seed certification, storage, enhanced security, a whole myriad of costs for the division, of which they're not doing right now. And then we got a fiscal note. It said zero, and this is not our division's. This is Commerce's problem. And I was really baffled by that. So, but I was actually expecting to say this is hemp is Commerce's problem, right? Because I don't see the difference. And I had a zero fiscal note on marijuana. And not that this isn't a marijuana bill. I understand that, but. And this isn't the Finance Committee, but I think we have to look at all aspects. And I'm really troubled when we get a fiscal note on a cultivation bill, which is basically what the aspect of we asked for their fiscal impact. And we got a punt over to Commerce and said, go talk to them, it's their problem, and with a zero fiscal note. And I'm summarizing that somewhat pejoratively, but not all that inaccurately. So I guess in fairness, I think I've given enough commentary to provide the question.
Ms. Habermeister, comments?
Through the chair, Senator Stoltz, I guess the difference that I see between this bill and the bill regarding marijuana is this bill or this language in hemp production would be allowed through the Farm Bill, and it is written into the Farm Bill that the Departments of Agriculture and the universities can be involved in research.
Well, follow up?
Madam Chair, the questions we asked in the previous committee and the ones we've asked this year have been in this committee have been about cultivation certification. Where would you see the we get to the certification and the THC testing? Who would be responsible for that in your division?
Through the chair, Senator Stoltz. At this time, the Division of Ag does not have the capability to do those THC tests. If there were funding to come through, potentially that could be done through us.
Madam Chair,
yes.
I'm not asking if funding is going to come through. Legislation is coming through, and there's implications for funding. I think we need to know not to pass the bill and then see if they need funding. That's sort of the fiscal note process a little backwards, and I don't think I'm going to get an answer here, Madam Chair. I would suggest there's been some political interaction with some of the departments and perhaps the governor's office not allowing accurate information on some of these bills, and I'm incredibly disappointed, and I'll just leave it at that. And I don't think I'm going to get any more answers here.
Thank you, Senator Stoltz. I do point out that the bill will go to finance, and so they will dig into it. It also goes to judiciary, actually, after us. So, but I appreciate the questions, and your point is well taken. So I see no other folks signed up online for public testimony or in the room. So I will leave public testimony open. Mr. Mosher, thank you for presenting the bill on behalf of the sponsor, Senator Ellis. We're going to set the bill aside and hopefully hear it again next week. Public testimony will be taken next week if there are additional folks that want to speak. So thank you.
Great. Thank you for your time, Madam Chair.
Thank you. All right, with that, we will move on to the next agenda item, which is House Joint Resolution number 4. This bill was heard earlier this week, and we have an amendment to the bill. So we're passing out those documents now. I'm going to invite Chad Hutchinson to the table, and also Kim Skipper, who is staff to the bill sponsor, Representative Dan Sadler. So committee members should have in their hands now the amendment. This amendment comes from Senator Coghill, which is why Mr. Hutchinson is at the table to walk us through it. So welcome, Mr. Hutchinson.
Madam Chair?
Yes, Senator.
If you wish, I can go ahead and move the amendment, maybe have an objection so that we can get it.
Okay.
All right. Mr. Chairman, Madam Chairman, Chairwoman, I would move the amendment. I think this is amendment number 1 to this, which was the A.2 amendment dated 3/2015.
Yes.
Thank you. And there's been an objection for purposes of discussion. So, Mr. Hutchinson.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Chad Hutchinson on the staff for Senator Coghill. I'm going to give an executive summary as to what the amendment stands for. First of all, we want to point out that it is an excellent resolution. The amendment was based on ongoing conversations that we've been having with Senator Murkowski's staff. Mike Pawlowski has been quite a resource when it comes to giving us some information as it relates to what's going on in Washington, D.C. and negotiations that they're having to increase Alaska's share of offshore revenue. I want to first talk about the amendments and a little bit of history to give clarification as to why you see what you're seeing. Alaska right now is privy to, is under the authority of the OCSL, which is the Outer Continental Shelf Lands Act, which basically means that we receive 27% of offshore revenues in an area 3 to 6 miles away from Alaska's coast. And the way that works is the 27% is taken out by the federal government whenever you have a leasing, when you have offshore leasing. It's taken out by the federal government and given back to the state, so the state can use that percentage to increase infrastructure, things like that, onshore. The only relevant field that is privy to this provision is the North Star field in the Beaufort Sea, but the expectation is that if you do get the Liberty field on, that you will see increased revenue because of that. But that's where Alaska currently stands. So we receive 27%. It's taken out by the federal government and is given back to the state, and they can use it for infrastructure. So concurrent to all that, you also have the Gulf of Mexico Energy Security Act, and that was, so you have what's going on in Alaska with 27%. You also have the Gulf of Mexico states that have a slightly different provision. They received 37.5% of the revenues that's gone from their offshore drilling. So the money's taken out by the federal government, and it's distributed back to Alabama, Texas, Louisiana, and Mississippi. And the reason why they get more is for a number of different reasons. This occurred in 2006. They had the right type of political influence. They had a tremendous amount of drilling, which is really a major portion of this. And they're in an area that's subject to hurricanes. So the states basically got together and said that, hey, look, we want more revenue for the amount of offshore development that we're doing. So they were able to get that pass, and they get 37.5%, while Alaska only gets 27%. Now, what Alaska wants to do is increase the amount of offshore revenue it gets from the federal government, and that's why you see the proposed changes that you see before you. This was a coordinated effort. Some of this is relevant from the perspective of you want to show it to the staff members, so people from Virginia, Wyoming, places like that. And the expectation is that Mr. Pawlowski has told us that he wants to use this resolution in his hand and go to the offices and advocate for increasing the amount that Alaska receives because of offshore drilling. So that's the executive summary, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Questions for Mr. Hutchinson. Senator Stoltz.
Thank you, commentary. I think Senator Coghill and staff have very artfully replaced a contentious provision, which would have disrupted a historical argument we've made, and made a much stronger provision here. I think this is a much improved resolution. I believe it would this require a title change resolution? Okay.
Mr. Hutchinson?
Senator Stoltz, through the chair, you are correct. It does require a title change resolution, and we've incorporated some of your comments to make sure that it was as broad as possible to.
Thank you. I believe the title change is on your amendment page. It's at the bolded section, so that will be incorporated. Senator Costello?
Thank you. And so obviously then we have one congressional office that has indicated support. Has our entire congressional delegation been contacted about this amendment, and what has their response been?
Senator Costello, through the chair, we do have briefings with some representatives from Senator Sullivan, but the primary person that's most familiar with the oil and gas is Mr. Pawlowski, and we do rely on him at this point to communicate the message to the other federal delegation, but we're certainly open to opening that communication to the other offices.
Further questions on the amendment?
One other comment?
Yes, Senator Coghill.
One of the other comments that we're trying to give as a tool to our congressional delegation is part of the discussion under the Gulf Coast Leasing Act is the move or potential move by the federal government to move the funding from the states that they are already getting now, the 37.5%, into other federal programs or conservation programs. And so this is adding our voice to, we think it should go to the states. And so it kind of strengthens a lot of the work that was done in the original resolution, and it adds kind of an exclamation point.
Very good. All right. I want to say that welcome Representative Sadler, who has joined us some time ago. Would you comment on whether you support the amendment or not? Welcome, Representative Sadler.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, Representative Dan Sadler, I appreciate your indulgence. We had another bill up elsewhere. For the record, I heartily support this. I appreciate Senator Coghill working to make a decent resolution better and more effective in the halls of Congress. So I do support the amendment language, yes.
Thank you very much, Representative Sadler. Further questions on the amendment? Seeing none.
Remove my objection.
The objection has been removed. Seeing no further objection, the amendment is adopted. So, any further discussion on the bill itself, on the resolution itself? Public testimony was left open on March 16th, so I have no one signed up online to testify. Is there anyone here in the room that wishes to testify on HJR 4? Seeing none, I'll close public testimony. So, further questions or discussion about the resolution itself? Yes, Senator Costello.
Thank you, and Madam Chair, I just wanted to make mention of the fact that this has bipartisan support in the other body, and that this, I think, is an important debate that Congress is going to be having, and it affects the future of Alaska significantly, so I just wanted to put that on the record.
Very good. Thank you for those comments. Senator Stoltz?
And thank you, Madam Chair. And I appreciate that Senator Murkowski is taking the lead on that. She is chair of the committee, but I bet you that Senator Solomon probably picked up a few things as DNR commissioner. His chief of staff probably did, too. And Don Young also knows quite a bit, having chaired the Natural Resources Committee for 6 years.
Points well taken. Thank you, Senator Stoltz. Further comments? All right. Senator Costello, I will entertain a motion.
Madam Chair, I move House Joint Resolution 4, Work Order 29-LS0281/A, as amended from committee with individual recommendations and attached zero fiscal note.
Seeing no objection, the resolution moves, and we will take a brief at ease to sign the transmittal documents. I call the Senate Resources Committee back to order. So the next item on the agenda is Senate Bill 57. So we will take up this bill again. It was last heard on Wednesday. And we stopped during public testimony. Commissioner Norm Roepberg from the RCA was on the phone. He is on the phone now and wishes to continue his comments on the bill. We also have on the phone Emma Polkin, who is the Assistant Attorney General with Department of Law. She's available for questions. So, Commissioner Roepberg, can you hear us?
Good afternoon, Madam Chair.
Welcome. So you were in the middle of giving some comments on the bill, so we welcome you back. Apologize for that interruption, but if you would like to continue, we would welcome hearing from you.
Thank you. I'm getting a little feedback, but just for the record, the comments I make are my own opinions that are not officially the RCA. You've attached observations I have made about the formal state comments submitted in December 1st, and I believe that I want to make clear what those comments are in reference to the bill. This legislation before us would require the drafting of a state implementation plan. Requirements of the bill, in my opinion, may probably prohibit the submission of a SIP from the state, and I'm greatly concerned about that. Not only would this, to follow the direction of the bill, the state will have to develop and proceed with a plan, but then we would run into the requirements of the bill, which I find somewhat troubling. And for example, in section A1, on page one of line 13, where the it indicates that will not result in increased electrical utility rates, but anyway would be have a disproportionate effect on households of lower moderate income. If I might refer the committee to page 7 of my comments, I'll just read very briefly so you don't have to look them up. This is referring to the activities of the impact of EPA's mandate because of the goals they set and its impact of shutting down Healy's plants 1 and 2 in Fairbanks, where the 45,000 ratepayers and GVA. We believe that the estimate of increased cost would be between 5 and 7 cents per kilowatt hour, bringing rates up to 29 to 31 cents a kilowatt hour, or a 26% increase because of the power plan that the EPA wants us to meet to those goals. The trouble is the analysis of this is extremely difficult. The RCA does not have the capability to be able to determine a distinction between low and moderate income from a broad retail rate. The impacts in Fairbanks would be $450 a year, but that's across all retail ratepayers. So you can make the assumption that if there's any increase, they will impact low and moderate ratepayers. Even if we do any kind of a plan which would decrease greenhouse gases, it's going to have an impact on the cost. Various states, for example, Texas, believe if they do an in-state plan, it will raise costs 10%, but they've let the EPA do it, it would be 44%. Similarly with the states of Ohio, 36%. So it goes across the board, so I'm concerned about that. Additionally, Subsection 2 regarding electrical reliability, resource inadequacy, and transmission is very vague and difficult. By transmission constraints, if the coal plants were shut down in Fairbanks, this would create or exacerbate the problems we have now. We have adequate transmission, but to a limited degree in terms of reliability into Fairbanks, but if the coal plants were shut down and their load were restricted, this would cause a problem. Additionally, number 3 a big part of the EPA plan is to introduce greater amount of renewables, but particularly energy efficiency. And this clearly will have an impairment on existing electrical generating capacity. And number four, obviously, if there's any reduction in particularly Healy 1, Golden Valley and our dockets have indicated that they're scheduling potential retirement of Healy 1 sometime around 2023 or in that range. I'm not sure how this impacts the meeting of the bill. It would have a cost and impact on employment. So clearly these are hurdles which I think basically may prohibit or restrict the ability of the state to do a plan. If this is hanging over the heads of the folks doing it, it may have an impact on the quality of the work. Section B1 areas have to do with electric power. Those are specifically areas that the RCA could look into. We have the ability to do most of these things, but they create an extra burden on us. And frankly, I think these situations, our goal is to get an exemption from the plan. Alaska is unique, as I testified yesterday, and I think we have an opportunity to get that exemption. But this particular bill, I think it's not really helpful because, frankly, the EPA will write a plan for us if we do not submit one. And if by asking for an exemption, if we pass this bill, it will be, why would the EPA then get us an exemption if they can turn around and write a plan for us? And frankly, it's an invitation and a gift to the EPA in an area of federal intrusion. The legislature in the state of Alaska has a long history of fighting against the intrusion on issues of policy into the state. And I think this is an open invitation for the EPA to enter into our state. And I think it's unfortunate that there's a notion that this not filing plan would be beneficial to the mining industry. And I'd like to try to dispel that notion. I think that it's not inappropriate, and I don't think it will be helpful at all. Our goal is to get an exemption from the EPA. Lacking that, we need to do a job by writing a plan that we can live with up here. And as I've said, I think the EPA wants the people of Fairbanks to live in a cold, dimly lit room, and this will do us no good. So with that, Madam Chair, I would be happy to take any questions you might have.
Thank you, Commissioner Wilkberg. Questions for Mr. Wilkberg. Senator Stedman.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. In the previous testimony, you stated that this Rule 111D would not impact our oil basin and on the North Slope. That seems to be a little different information than what I hear from the companies. So could you enlighten us a little bit, Mr. Wilkberg, on that, on your feelings on that subject?
I'm sorry, Senator Stedman, I had a little trouble. You were talking about the North Slope and oil.
Being exempt from the 111D. My understanding from some of the company guys I've talked to there, that it would impact our oil industry, not just Anchorage, Fairbanks, and Matsu's rail belt area.
At this juncture, the 111D provisions is only related to five utilities and the generation specific plants on the rail belt. It has no impact at this juncture on the North Slope. And that's one of the problems. Almost in every other state, these designs are statewide. But in Alaska, it's unique in the sense that they're restricting the enforcement to the rail belt area. And that's why I mentioned the other day, the vast they've made in renewables and in energy efficiencies are not even being counted by the EPA. Additionally, we have an entire new set of generation fleet throughout the rail belt. And some of those, they're using a 2012 baseline date, and we have to convince them by writing a plan that will do so that we should be able to count these new plans. Plants that we have, for example, in Anchorage, Homer, in the Mad Valley, as well as the Healy 2, which was not included in the baseline calculations by the EPA. So it's important that we make our voice heard. But they do not affect anything but electrical generation. There is moves afoot by the EPA to move into other manufacturing areas and also in the oil patch, I believe. But they're separate issues.
Thank you, Phillips. Senator Stidman.
Well, I think that's something, subject matter, Madam Chairman, that we need to understand thoroughly. It's our biggest industry, and my understanding from the industry that this will affect them.
Thank you. Further questions from committee members?
Go ahead.
Commissioner Roper, you commented that this will invite the EPA into Alaska. I think they're already here. We've gotten letters of support from ARCTEC, which is the Rail Belt Cooperative Transmission and Electric Group. We've got the Alaska Chamber, the Teamsters, the Fairbanks Chamber, Consumer Energy Alliance, the Miners Association. I mean, diverse groups. GBA has also spoken in favor of the bill. You know, I'm not sure what you're advocating for. We're advocating for in the bill at the very onset a waiver, an exemption. To have the rest of the data available to the legislature before any kind of plan would be submitted seems only transparent.
Madam Chair, I have to compliment you in getting a large group of folks to support this legislation, and you've done an excellent job. I don't think, in my considered opinion, given my background as a former legislature, I believe that that's the basis for my compliment. On the other hand, my analysis of the bill itself, I believe, is based on the premise that submitting a plan is not good and that the requirements within the bill do not serve ultimately our purposes in seeking, number one, an exemption, number two, in accomplishing a plan that will benefit Alaskans. It adds additional work, and the degree of analysis cannot even be performed in many sections of the bill by the departments. They don't have economists on staff, which gave rise to the fiscal note you have before you. In addition, it also mandates or gives the authority to the Department of Environmental Conservation, whereas the original comments were developed by a working group that cuts across numerous agencies that have expertise in this that will be able to do that. In doing so, if you did that, then you'd have potentially further fiscal notes because of the need to outside economic analysis. These issues that you've raised here are more or less macro questions that don't specifically lend themselves to writing a plan. So,
well, thank you for that. In fact, DEC does have an economist on staff, and this pertains to the fiscal note, which I was going to bring up during this meeting. I actually have a zero fiscal note for this bill. It comes about because of House Bill 140, which we passed last year. This was a bill that required that the departments produce a good faith estimate on the cost of implementing regulations. Federal actions that require compliance was explicitly written into the statute through House Bill 140. That funding, which amounts to $278,000 in FY16, provides for the procurement of an Economist 3 position, as well as contractual assistance for the development of cost estimates, including data collection, analysis, and report of findings in the amount required for the contract. For committee members who are receiving the zero fiscal note, it's on page 2 in the notes, spelled out. So Senate Bill 57 would require the Department of Environmental Conservation to perform this analysis. They have the money. It is unencumbered for FY16. So they have the resources to perform this. The original fiscal note estimated about $100,000 over the two fiscal years for the contractual assistance. That would be included in what was passed last year. So, in fact, this bill has a zero fiscal note.
Mr. Chair, Madam Chair.
Yes, Senator Stedman.
Speaking of the fiscal note, just generally speaking, I get a little hesitant when committees start zeroing out, messing around with fiscal notes. From past experience, I've seen certain individuals, good quality members of our Senate, create fiscal notes to avoid the Finance Committee for whatever reason. So I'm always a little gun-shy when fiscal notes are zeroed out or monkeyed with or better left, in my opinion, of the Finance Committee. That's what they do.
Thank you, Senator Stedman. This actually came through legislative finance, the information that is contained in this fiscal note. So I guess you could say I did go through finance. Further questions, comments? Senator Costello.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Is there somebody from the Department of Law online who can ask? Okay.
Yes, would you like to speak? Her name is Emma Polkin.
Emma
Polkin?
Polkin.
Would you like to ask her some questions?
Yes.
Emma, can you hear us?
Yes, I can hear you.
Welcome. If you would identify yourself for the record and your position at Department of Law, then Senator Costello has some questions for you.
My name is Emma Polkin. I'm an Assistant Attorney General with the Department of Law.
Welcome. Senator Costello.
Thank you. Through the chair, Ms. Polkin, it's my understanding that states are preparing to push back against the EPA because there's a belief that the 111D does not authorize the ability to regulate in this manner. And I was curious as to your opinion, by virtue of, in a way, we're implicitly recognizing that the EPA's power, that they do have that authority by then responding in a manner in which this legislation does, which is to, as the Madam Chair has mentioned, to allow us to seek an exemption or a waiver. So how does that work? If the EPA doesn't have the authority to do this, and then the state comes forward with a request for the administration to prepare a waiver or an exemption, doesn't that imply that we agree that the EPA has that authority?
So the state is currently participating in litigation in the D.C. Circuit challenging the 111D rule and EPA's authority to issue the proposed regulation. As to what message might be sent by this legislation or by any changes that might be made to it would be something that is outside of, I think, the realm of legal questions that I'm prepared to answer. I would say, though, that EPA is continuing to say that they believe they have the authority for this. They've proposed the rule. They're saying that it will be issued this coming summer, and it'll be the court in the end that decides whether or not EPA has the authority.
And follow-up, Senator Costello.
I sit on the Department of Law's Budget Subcommittee, and during the hearing earlier this week, I had asked the AG-elect, Craig Richards, his opinion about or what the state's plan is in pushing back against the 111D, and if I might read from the memo that I received from him.
Thank you.
He writes in his letter, dated March 18th of this year, the Clean Power Plan rule is an example of an area where the state felt it necessary to push back against the Environmental Protection Agency. And then it goes on to mention what Ms. Pokin said, is that the state is essentially submitting comments dealing with the EPA's interpretation and how they believe it is wrong. And as part of the comment letter, the state attached a legal analysis, which I have here, and explains why the state believes the EPA's proposed interpretation is improper. And then it mentions that the state is intervening in a lawsuit. And my concern is that we've got the Department of Law engaged in this issue. And while I believe that it is significant and important that the state be involved, I'm just concerned that if one branch of our government is fighting the EPA's authority to do this and another branch of government is fighting in our own way, which is what we have here, it's our effort to fight this. I'm wondering about the timing of that. In addition, it says on page 1, on lines 10 through 12, that we may not submit a plan that will not result in, and then it lists several items that our plan must not affect these things, and they include essentially all the reasons why the states across America are have our eyes wide open to this issue, because it's impossible for this overreach of the EPA to ask the states to meet these requirements that don't have an increase to cost to the consumer. And I do understand that we live in a carbon-constrained world, but I am very much against the EPA going outside of their authority, and I think that I'm wondering if the Department of Law is the best entity in the state to be first pushing back before the legislature weighs in. And I'm not sure who could answer that question. Perhaps you can, or Ms. Pokin can.
Sure. Ms. Pokin, do you have a comment?
I'm not really in a position to comment on what branch of government should be first to make a statement about the EPA's authority or not. This litigation was initiated some time ago, but in the last administration, and so the decision has been made, I believe, to continue on with it. But whether or not it should be the legislature speaking first or the Department of Law, I'm not in a position to make a comment on.
Thank you. So, Senator Costello, my comment to that would be this is a second line of defense. Clearly, the Department of Law has entered into this challenge against the EPA, but should that fail, we stand as the second line of defense, and that's what this piece of legislation represents, that second line of defense for our consumers, for our Alaska citizens. Senator Wadakowski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the Department of Law, if the state, so if we pass this legislation and then we try to put a plan in place and the feds reject that plan, then what happens?
If the state does not have a approved state plan, then there will be a federal implementation plan under the terms of the Clean Air Act.
Okay. And if I, just a couple questions.
Yes, do you
have any sense of what the likelihood is that the state will receive an exemption from submitting a plan as required by the Clean Power Plan?
Alaska has been exempted previously from other EPA regulations, or they've made special accommodations for Alaska previously. However, there's a lot of factors that would go into evaluating whether or not EPA might give Alaska an exemption in this case.
Do you know how many other states have requested waivers and whether or not they've been granted exemptions?
To my knowledge, I have not seen another specific request for an exemption or waiver from the rule. Other states have objected to EPA's authority or have commented in a negative fashion.
Yes, follow up.
And to the extent that you can answer us, do we have DEC online as well, Madam Chair?
I'm sorry.
Do we have DEC online?
DEC is not online, but they are in the room.
Okay. I may have some questions for them, but maybe Law can answer this. But is it possible that we could fail to produce an SIP in accordance with our own stringent criteria and in turn cause ourselves to be subject to a federal implementation plan if we pass this legislation?
My reading of Senate Bill 57 is that the would require DEC to make affirmative determinations of the effect of the state plan, and that DEC would not be submitting a state plan for approval to EPA until those determinations could be made. If that's what is intended, then EPA would not be receiving If DEC could not make those findings, could not reach those determinations, then they wouldn't be submitting a state plan, which under the terms of the Clean Air Act would then result in a federal implementation plan.
Follow-up.
So in other words, we could be making it so hard for DEC to come up with a plan that meets federal requirements such that the federal government rejects it and then implements a federal plan. Is that fair to say?
That's a possible outcome, but it would depend upon the findings and the determinations done by the agency.
Thank you.
But if they can't make those findings, then yes.
Did you have a question,
yes.
Senator Kalkiel?
A question, yes, ma'am.
Yes.
Thank you. First of all, I appreciate. I like what we're trying to do here under 57. So maybe it's the line of defense, as you said, how it fits in there. So maybe this should go into effect if they start giving us a hard time on the exemption rather than us doing it before the exemption request. Because I think we should go for an exemption while we're fighting the constitutionality of the main EPA ruling. And then if our exemption isn't granted, then we go down this road, because then civil disobedience is what we're going to have to deal with at that point. And I personally, I like the idea of showing diligence, number one, I think, because we're asking what's the cost to Alaskans. But I'm sure maybe for the law here, would it fit better if we went ahead and asked for the exemption and then had this as the backdrop, or should we start here? Maybe that's your policy question. That's probably not the Department of Law. And maybe what I should do is ask DEC what they have already applied for before I get too far ahead into the Department of Law. So maybe we should have DEC come up, Madam Chair, and I'll let the law off the hook, because really that's a process question, more of a legal question.
It's a policy apologies. Question.
Yeah.
You're right. Could I have Alice come forward, DEC?
Madam Chair, can I?
Yes, Senator Stoltz. Sure, while she's coming forward, of course.
Yeah, I'd like to know, I guess I have a little confusion where these 111D provisions are. Are they actually implemented yet? Are they in the development process? Is there a comment period? I guess, where are we, and does that change the relevancy and how we might approach this?
We have DEC at the table.
The relevance. I don't
Welcome.
Relevance.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, I'm Alice Edwards. I'm the Deputy Commissioner for the Department of Environmental Conservation. So I think there were a couple of questions here. So, Madam Chair, I'll defer to you. Where would you like to start?
Wherever you would like to start. There were numerous questions.
Well, Madam Chair.
Yes, Senator Coghill.
Is the timing of the comments on this, and then have we already applied for exemption? Because it says before, we might go retroactive on you under this, and if you've already started. So probably where we're at on 111D, how they found it, what's the timing, and then that question.
Okay, thank you, Senator Kalko. Through the chair, EPA has not finalized the rulemaking for 111D. The state submitted comments on December 1st, which was at the end of the comment period. EPA has indicated that they will be finalizing their rulemaking in this summer of 2015. In our comments to EPA, and this was multi-agency comments on behalf of the state, so it came from Regulatory Commission of Alaska, Alaska Energy Authority, Department of Environmental Conservation, and of course from the Governor's Office, we did request within those comments an exemption from EPA for this rulemaking, along with other comments associated with the rulemaking. So there was an exemption request made within the comment letter. That being said, we don't have the final rulemaking. We don't know the structure, and we don't know, I think, for certain whether or not an exemption will be granted by EPA, as the representative from the Department of Law indicated. But we have initiated that request within the comment letter.
Right. Okay.
Further questions?
No, that's kind of what I wanted to know, because I've got their comments here. And the first question is just the constitutionality of this proposed rule, true? And I think we need to stay there as long as we can. But the backup plan, I tend to agree, we want to explain the whole impacts to Alaska as we move forward. So you asked for an exemption in your comments. Would this work to back that up? Why would it weaken that position?
Through the chair, Senator Coghill, that's a good question. I mean, in the comments, we did, the state comments sort of take three approaches. They start with the sort of legal aspects, which the Department of Law spoke about. We asked for the exemption, and then we asked for, and you know, depending on where EPA landed, we also put in information that might help to address some of the rulemaking issues if they moved forward and neither of those options came through. So I think the real question becomes, in my mind, in the end, we don't know yet. It's a little speculative on my part because we don't know what the final rule is going to look like from EPA. We don't know how they're going to address our comments. We don't know how the litigation is going to be resolved. But ultimately, in the end, if the litigation depending on how the results of that litigation, if we failed to get an exemption, then the question is, how would we go about developing a state plan, and what would those requirements look like? We don't know what those federal requirements would be, and the question is, will the bill allow us to develop that state plan and meet those requirements in the bill as well?
So I apologize to committee members. I see now that we are after 5 o'clock. And so I know it's Friday night and folks want to be moving on. I am happy to stop at this point, have Alice return. You can put your questions together, and we can hear this again another time. Is that acceptable to committee? Looks like it. Okay. Senator Sedman, did you have to want to make a comment prior?
Just a point of clarification.
Sure.
Says the preparer of the fiscal note is the Senate Resources Committee.
It may say that, but the consultant to it was Legislative Finance.
Could be.
Thank you. All right. Senator Costello.
And thank you for this leeway. I appreciate your attention to the time. When we see you again, would it be possible to have the department comment on what my concern is, which is that it is we cannot submit a plan that shows there is no retail electric service rate increase. I think that every state across the nation realizes that that's who will pay is the consumer. And so if we say that we have to submit a plan that has no effect on increased retail electric service rates, then if you look at what the Department of Law's memo was, which is that if we don't submit a plan, then the EPA will submit one for us. So we are essentially tying our hands, or are we tying our hands is my question, with the way this is written, can we be successful in creating a plan that meets these constraints? Thank you, Madam Chair.
You're welcome. Any other questions that folks would like to have submitted, you can certainly send them to my office. We'll send them on to DEC. So
At this time, we'll conclude today's meeting. Our next hearing is Monday, March 23rd. We're going to take up Mr. Craig Richards' confirmation hearing for Attorney General, as well as the confirmation of Mr. Hugh Short to the Board of the Alaska Gasoline Development Corporation. Alice, thank you so much for being here. We'll certainly give you plenty of ahead of time notice when the bill will be heard again. So at this time, we will adjourn the meeting. Let the record reflect. The time is 5:04 p.m.